Because there's also correspondence of 90% between Deuteronomy and the treaty in more detailed points. And that can open up new insights into the meaning of certain words and concepts that you find in the book of Deuteronomy. The correspondence between the treaty and the book of Deuteronomy, in specific word use, certain concepts, is also an area where there's a lot of profitable study to be done. Now, Klein points out a few things of that sort also. One illustration, page 24. The increased emphasis on the covenantal context of the law, that central element of Deuteronomy, chapter 5 to 26, the stipulation. Increased emphasis on the covenantal context of the law underscores the essential continuity in the function of law in the Old and New Testament. The covenantal concept of law. Underscores the essential continuity in the function of law in the Old and New Testament. Well, I think there's a point there that should be elaborated on greatly. But in the structure of the treaty, you have the great king who does certain beneficent things for his vassals. There are gracious acts involved. I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. The vassals respond out of thanksgiving. It could be one of living up to the demands of the stipulation. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't also certain sanctions that also reinforce that obligation. But you might say grace there precedes law in the sense of that brings it into the Deuteronomic context. God has chosen a certain people. He's redeemed that people. He's brought them out of Egypt. He's cared for them in the wilderness. Now, here are your obligations. Those obligations are to be performed out of a sense of thanksgiving and love for the great king who has done so much for them. Prince of the Nephites, if you love me, keep my commandments, right? There are certain fundamental, there is a fundamental unity in the context of the obligation to the law that you find in the Old and New Testament that is underscored by this understanding of the structure of Deuteronomy and of the nature of the Sinaitic covenant. Which leads me right into the next point. There's been an article written on the term the love of God in Deuteronomy, in the book of Deuteronomy. I think I have that listed on this bibliographic sheet here. Under Deuteronomy in the treaty form, W.L. Moran, the Inquiry, Some Background of the Love of God in Deuteronomy, in the Catholic Biblical Quarterly, 1963. D.J. McCarthy, Notes on the Love of God in Deuteronomy and the Father-Son Relationship between Yahweh and Israel. You might want to look at those articles. Very interesting articles. In this book, D.R. Hiller's Covenant, The History of a Biblical Idea, he summarizes some of that material, page 152. The love of God is a peculiar stress of Deuteronomy, and a still more remarkable instance of the book's conservation of very old covenant ideas. Now, Hiller's view is not so much for the Mosaic origin of all this material, but he finds the structure, he finds the language, and it's a lot of useful material, and you have to use it. Hiller's book critically, however. He says, love has been used in such a variety of ways in Western history that considerable scholarly effort has been devoted to discriminating the various species of affection to which the term has been applied. Deuteronomy's brand of love is an especially interesting one for two reasons. It represents a type of love very different from most recent conceptions, and it is the mother lode of much other influential biblical teaching about love for God. Love, in Deuteronomy, can be commanded. Chapter 6, verse 5, you shall love Yahweh your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your might. This means living in a relation of worship and service to the deity. Chapter 11, 1, you shall love Yahweh your God, keep his observances, his statutes, his laws, his commandments for all time. The whole commandment, 11:22, can be summed up thus, quote, to love Yahweh your God, to walk in all his ways, to cleave to him. 11:13, to love Yahweh is linked inseparably with to serve him. To love Yahweh is to serve him. We've heard these words so often that their doctrine does not seem surprising, but we need to remember that one theory of love, a very potent influence, has held that duty and love are incompatible. Here, they are nearly identified. And Hillard says, it is W.L. Moran, this is the article I was referring to, who has identified the language of treaties and covenants as the profane source for this conception of the love of God. Though there may be earlier examples, the first common use of love in the language of diplomacy is found in the archives of El Amarna. The relation that exists between brothers, that is, equal partners in a treaty, is love. In the treaty text, you get arrangements between brothers or equal partners. The relationship is one of, quote, love. May my brother preserve love toward me 10 times more than did his father. We will go on loving my brother fervently. From the Amarna letter. This love is not only the proper feeling between equal partners, however, but it is the way that Pharaoh regards his vassals. Also from the Amarna letter, if the king, my lord, loves his faithful servant, let him send back the 3 men. Now that's from some vassal. If the king, my lord, loves his faithful servant, let him send back the 3 men. Above all, it is the way vassals are to consider their lord. To love is equal to being a servant. My lord, quote, just as I love the king, my lord, so do the king of Nuhasi, the king of Ni, all these kings are servants of my lord. In the Esarhaddon Treaty, love is commanded as a duty toward the suzerain. You will love Ashurbanipal as yourself. What I won't go through a lot of the rest of the material, and you can read the article, but what it boils down to is this, that love in the treaty text becomes synonymous with obedience. When you love the Lord, you obey the stipulation. So that love can be commanded then. You are to love the Lord. You are to obey the stipulation. It says love is demonstrated in that. So that there are many illustrations of that sort of thing where you find similar use of words in treaty documents that gives you some insight into a lot of the biblical material. Now again, you don't want to read all the biblical material under the total control of extra-biblical material. But extra-biblical material as far as thoughts, forms, that sort of thing that were extant in the time in which those documents originated can help you understand connotations of meaning that you find in the biblical material. And there are many similarities in language and in concepts and specific points that can be pointed to in treaty texts and found also in Deuteronomy. Now, we'll notice some more of that as we progress during the course. But that's another area where there is a great deal of work that has been done already and a great deal more work which can be done. I'd like to move on now to a new heading. Capital C, just to review, to get your continuity. Meredith Klein, making use of a form critical approach which honors the integrity of the scripture, has opened this new perspective on the nature and structure of Deuteronomy, which in turn has implications for its interpretation and date. That was C. Klein's whole thesis opened up a new perspective, has implications for interpretation and date. We looked at what that basic thesis was, what the fundamental ideas of it are. Now, capital B. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications. The present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. The covenant form in the Old Testament and its historical implications, - the present state of affairs in the Deuteronomy debate. Number one under D, I'll use this term because it's a technical term that certainly applies here. Number one, the sit-in waving of the covenant form. The practical implications of its presence. The sit-in waving, a situation in life of the covenant form, and the historical implications of its presence. The situation in life of the covenant form has historical implications of its presence. There's widespread agreement, pretty much across the board, that the covenant form is a discernible and important literary feature of the Old Testament. Now that's something that's developed in the last 10 to 15 years, but there's general agreement that there is such a thing, that it's discernible, that it's present in the Old Testament. It can be found in, with more debate, but it can be found in Exodus 19:24, Sinai. If I make universal agreement, it's found in Deuteronomy. With about as much agreement, it's found in Joshua 24. And numerous other passages, won't list all of them. But there is this widespread agreement of the existence of what you could call a covenant form, and that it's an important literary feature of the Old Testament. There is, however, no corresponding agreement on the origin of this phenomenon. Where did it come from? There's no corresponding agreement on the question of the origin of this phenomenon, and therefore on the historical implications which may or may not be drawn from its admitted presence. It's admitted that it's there, but there's no corresponding agreement on the origin of the form, and therefore on the historical implications which may be drawn from the presence of the form. Pardon? And in some, yeah.
Just to get this, the fourth time was the most canon. that the form does exist, but there isn't immunity for it coming from where it came from.
Where it came for it from, or there's historical implications then it can be drawn from. In some circles, there's expressed resistance to attempts which have been made by, for example, Klein and others, to draw historical conclusions from the fact of the presence of the form. There's been resistance to the attempts to draw historical conclusions from the fact that the form does exist, that it exists. But then, you know, what are you going to do with it? What conclusions are you going to draw from that? Well, right at that point, some have begun to resist drawing historical conclusions from the admitted presence of a form. For example, and it's not so important that you take these examples all down, but I just want to give you an idea here of this particular position. There is a book called The Southern Formulary. By A-R-E-R. The Southern Formulary by Klaus Holzer. It's a book which traces the occurrence of covenant form throughout the Old Testament, since passage finds a form there. And down into the Dead Sea Scrolls. In that book, page 7, note 49, commenting on the original article by Mendenhall. Mendenhall, you remember, is the one who initiated this whole discussion, his article on law and covenant nature on the ancient Near East, and drew the analogy with that treaty, covenant, form, and similar. Mendenhall started the whole thing. Holzer, commenting on Mendenhall's article, says of Mendenhall, he's more interested in historical questions. While the present work limits itself to the form-critical approach, no doubt further conclusions, not least in the historical sphere, can be drawn on the basis of this beginning, but I consider it methodologically dangerous to bring both sets of questions together prematurely, and he resists moving towards historical conclusions to be drawn from the present to the form. A Roman Catholic scholar reviewing Balter's work, The Covenant Formulary, says Balter insists throughout on a sharp separation between his form critical investigation and the historicity of the episodes narrated. This reserve toward matters historical, which still lies far short of skepticism, owes its vigor to the influence of Altmos and von Rau. In this way, Balter has successfully avoided hasty and premature conclusions. An author has the right to delimit his scope and material, but it's disappointing that Balter eschews historical conclusions. Balter, he's not willing to start going to Gretchen Klein and drawing these historical conclusions in relation to Arden reform and its mosaic setting, that sort of thing. D.J. McCarthy, I'll just read you this, you need not get the documentation for it. An article on Biblica, reviewing a German book on this general subject, says of the treaty covenant analogy, quote, "No doubt too much has been claimed for the analogy, and especially illegitimate historical conclusions have been drawn from it." Now, he doesn't say who he's talking about. He says, still, this does not invalidate such evidence as there is for the analogy. Analogy is there, but don't draw too hasty or illegitimate historical conclusions then. So, the point I wanted to make at this point is that this resistance has arisen to withdrawing of historical conclusions from the admitted presence of the literary form. Now, I think a word is in order at this point. Certainly caution should be used in use of the form critical method to draw historical conclusions. Because it's precisely in this area that there's been such wild theories proposed for the origins of certain forms. And there's an enormous amount of subjectivity that can become involved in that whole process. So there's a caution in order there. However, the presence of a certain form, on the other hand, presupposes a historical setting which has given rise to the form in question. If you have a literary form of a particular definable type, that form presupposes a historical setting which has given rise to the form in question. You have a telegram, you know where that comes from. You have a advertising sheet, but there's a certain context in which that kind of literature is utilized and out of which it rises. So literary forms do presuppose certain kinds of historical settings. And insight into the reason for and significance of the utilization of the form can be gotten by determining the historical setting which gave rise to it. So that a judicious attempt to delineate the historical setting for a particular form can be a useful interpretive tool. And I think in the case of the covenant form, you have this form in the Old Testament. The question of when and how it was adopted in Israel, and that is of fundamental significance. And if you avoid that question of when and how it was adopted in Israel, you impoverish the study of the form. You can even go into perhaps misinterpretations of the significance of the form if you don't understand where it came from, what its original study was. So that caution is ordered, in order. Certainly there is also a great deal of significance to be attached to this question. What was the purpose of and the time of the original adoption of this form in Israelite usage? Yeah.
I'm wondering how much of a correspondence is there between the form critical idea, say, that Klein uses, and that of the traditional form criticism. I get the impression, say, from Dunkel, that the form goes back not necessarily to a concrete situation that happened with gave rise to the form, but more of a tradition type of thing. A band of roving poets that would go around telling stories which developed into a document or something like that.
Yeah, well, I'd say in many instances, and what you're saying is one, I think, in many instances, the definition of the situation note, the situation noting that gave rise to particular form is purely and totally hypothetical. And really the creation of the genius or imagination or whatever of the particular critic who was saying here's a form and it originated here with no evidence that it originated there. You know, he creates that situation in order to explain the form. An awful lot of that goes on, and it becomes very subjective, and based on frequently little or no evidence, and purely hypothetical. And I think you have to be very leery of that, and stay away from that kind of utilization of a form critical method. But on the other hand, these niggers, the legitimate use of a form critical method, illustrates case in point. Here you have a covenant form. Where did that form come from? What's the explanation of the origin of it? What situation in life is the most likely explanation for its adoption? And when in Israel's history would there be a situation that would give rise to a form that had such enormous influence in the whole subsequent history of the nation? Forms of worship, means of expression, the whole thing, you know? Seems to me that there's a lot of evidence then to point back to the Bible does itself, to the event of Sinai being the situation in life, which gave rise to the form. Under this question then. One, fixed in Laban of the Covenant Forum, historical implications of its presence, small a. The nature of the Covenant Forum and its origin. The nature of the Covenant Forum and its origin. And then dash, cultic, question mark, or historical. Cultic or historical. The nature of the Covenant Forum and its origin. Cultic or historical. And I'm going to have to hold our discussion just to go time yet. That becomes a significant question, particularly in today's debate, and particularly as concerns by God. He recognizes the form, he applies it some sort of cultic origin. You can't totally separate cultic and historical, but in Von Rad's framework, I think to put it this way, gets to the point of what's being done. Pick up there on Monday.